back to the processes. All part of the hearing. Regards to the person taking issue of pregnancy, I want to may I quickly say here, as I think it's shown very much in front of all of us, it's good to be back. It's said that I think that, best to you, I say, the main pastor of all the tradition to be is not about the benefits of the decision. Very much important to us about for all of us who are there. Some of us, therefore, in the way of what we say, and so far as that we're here, to challenge humanity, what is not only the key to such things of trust.
I'm saying the most important thing for all of us at the departure point here is that the preparations that you today and tomorrow, right? Today and tomorrow
are not up the validity or the substance or content of the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy Act 92 of 1996. That's not really the thing, because the Constitutional Court did not find this legislation invalid. That's what I want to stress firstly. But I think what was found to be invalid or questioned where the procedures, processes of public hearings with regard to the legislation. The view was that the public was not given adequate time to make their own submissions in terms of the deliberation thereof. I think it's a very much important point. There too, there were therefore certain amendments or certain procedures to be followed. I think I just thought as members are going to deliberate around this particular issue. I think that important departure point is going to be very much important for all of us. This main thrust here is about the consultation. We have a number of submissions that have I think we really want to thank in particular members of the public. If my calculation is right, I think last time I counted 58, but I think you will see that in your package, further to that, we have over 100 submissions that we actually received. We really want, in particular, to thank the members of the public for these submissions and also for your presence here today. We shall then be taking the submissions as proposed by the committee section here, and I'm told the actual final program is being drafted, and I'm sure all members will be having it, so as to know exactly how you're going to be dealing with it. And in this regard, therefore, I'm not going to go into the substance myself. The first submission that we are going to be having is from the Justice Alliance of South Africa, Mr. John Smith. Is he present? Mr. John Smith, thank you very much. Mr. President, that will be the first submission we are going to be entertaining, and I really want to thank you in particular, sir, for your attendance in this regard, and we are going to firstly try to hope that we get the submissions of yourself from our package. It's quite a big pile, so it's a bit difficult sometimes to page through all the documents. Before that, Honorable Dudley Sherry.
Thank you, Chair. Just on a point of clarity, just to get what you said here, you're suggesting that this is only about process and not about substance. Are you saying that members of Parliament are not going to apply their mind to the substance of these submissions? If so, I just want to ask the question, would the court seriously expect members of Parliament to have a hearing in which they don't actually listen to the substance of those proposals?
No, that's a good point. And I'm sure you've listened to the chair very carefully. You was very careful not to come to that particular angle. trying therefore to say that we are not going to listen to the substance. All what one was saying, what was the thrust of the ruling? It must be something we bear in mind as we deliver it. There will be a number of views coming from a number of eminent persons here who are coming to make those submissions. We are going to interact with them. But at the back of our mind, let's bear that particular important point into account.
As far as I understand it, the constitutional ruling didn't mention the actual substance of the amendment simply because that wasn't what was taken to court. It was the fact of lack of consultation. So therefore there was no need to rule on that particular matter either.
That's your opinion.
Yeah, and you expressed your opinion as well.
I'm not expressing my opinion, I'm expressing the ruling of the constitutional court.
Yeah, but it had nothing to do with the substance.
It
didn't go.
That's your opinion. You are going to choose whether you want to participate in the process or not. And I'm going to move forward. I'm looking for the submission, sorry for your delay. I'm just looking for your submission of the Justice Alliance 03.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No. Before you proceed, I want to get the copy. It's a number? Oh, you are a star. Thank you very much. See, the other point maybe I want to emphasize on a member to deliberate. As you know, the legal people, I think the Constitutional Court said if we fail to process this by February, then its ruling will then proceed with its own determination. Am I right, Mukesh? Can you just clarify that? I remember something.
Thanks. Thanks, Chairperson. Yes, the Constitutional Court did set a deadline as February, which meant that they were giving us an opportunity, or the Parliament opportunity, to reprocess the bills until February, so that if it's not done by February, then the order of invalidity will then kick in, which will mean that the acts are, should be removed totally from the not the acts, but the amendment bills will be removed totally from the registration of bills in parliament, so to say.
I think it's important, but therefore, but I'm sure we'll meet the deadline if we are diligent in doing our work here. Yeah.
I can ask a point of clarity. Can we not ask for an extension? I think the parliamentary law advisor mentioned that even if we don't meet the deadline, we can apply for an extension to the Constitutional Court. Maybe you can just get the opinion of the department there. Thanks.
Why do we want to put an obstacle to something in front of us now? And if we're diligent, we have to get our trousers properly and do the work. We can finish. Why do you want to be lazy before we start the work? Let's do the work. I'm sure we'll finish. The program is there. Let's not begin to be defeatist even before we start. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, may I assist by saying I'm happy to start with my submission without you having the document, if that would assist the committee.
Yes, I want to confess that I don't want tomorrow to be said that I was compared to any of them. If they themselves agree with me, I want to be fair. Can you ask them about the other things that come? The new one, the new one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm the Honorary Director of the Justice Alliance of South Africa, known as JASA, and may I be the first to thank you for arranging these public hearings. Many of us here, I think, certainly I'm one, and my organization is one, have made submissions in the provincial public hearings. But JASA, and I'm sure other stakeholders and members of the public, are particularly grateful for this opportunity to make submissions to the National Assembly in view of the course which the bill took in the NCOP. And that leads me to say immediately that there are two matters that I would like to raise by way of introduction which arise out of the course which the bill took in the NCOP and against the background of the Doctors for Life case which has already been referred to this morning. First of all, we would like to respectfully stress that the duty on all legislators, whether it's the provincial parliaments, the NCOP, or the National Assembly, is meaningfully to consider all inputs from the public on the topic of the bill, not merely to deal with the clauses already drafted. Now, on page 2, in fact, page 1, if one ignores the cover page of our submission, for those who have got it, our written submission, I have set out a quotation from the court at paragraph 171 of the court's judgment. And may I read that? It's very short. The requirement that participation must be facilitated where it is most meaningful has both symbolic and practical objectives. The persons concerned must be manifestly shown the respect due to them as concerned citizens, and the legislators must have the benefit of all inputs that will enable them to produce the best possible laws. And of course, by implication, the whole judgment underlines the importance of the duty of looking at all inputs which are relevant to the subject of the bill. What the court said, I was very closely involved personally with that case, I was in fact the architect of it. What the court says is that the duty is to involve public involvement when a bill is controversial. And members of the committee will remember that there were two other bills which were also taken in the same case to the Constitutional Court, the Dental Technicians Bill and another bill I just forget the name of, and the court said, no, these bills aren't controversial, so there wasn't the same duty to have public hearings. But it's when a bill is controversial that all these things have to be looked at. Now, what is controversial about the bill which is before the committee this morning? It's not what is in the bill, but it is what is not in the bill. I think you will find that almost all those of us who make submissions to you are saying there need to be additions to this bill in order to make the 1996 Act work properly. That is the controversial issue, the controversial area. The fact that the 1996 Act, the principal act, is not working properly, is not being complied with. And so what JASA is saying, and I suspect many others, is that it is essential to consider additions to the bill which will remedy the defects or the fact that the 1996 bill is not working as it should. Having said that, may I qualify that to this extent? We are not seeking to introduce new matters. Even those who believe that abortion, TOPs, should be more readily available than they are at the moment, and goodness knows we have 60, 70, 80,000 a year, there are those who feel, no, we need to make the facilities even more readily available. It's still incumbent upon all of us to uphold the rule of law, and that means to make sure that the checks and balances in the 1996 Act are being complied with and work properly. If you have an act like the 1996 Act, which provides checks and balances, says TOPs shall only be done at certain stages, subject to certain conditions, and those checks and balances are being ignored, then an amendment bill is, we submit, the classic opportunity, the proper opportunity, for introducing new clauses to make sure that these abuses cease, in order that the rule of law should be upheld. Because if you have an act on the statute book and the penalties, the conduct which is forbidden is going on all the time, as we submit is the case with the 1996 Act, then that is an affront to the rule of law and a blot on the nation of South Africa. Now, with that introduction, may I go straight into the five areas of concern which were identified by the Department of Health in their meeting with the NCOP Social Services Select Committee on the 11th of September. What happened, as you know, is that there were an enormous number, I think something approaching 100 public hearings throughout the country in the 9 different provinces. And as a result of that, negotiating mandates were submitted by the provinces to the NCOP Social Services Select Committee. And the Department of Health were asked for their input on those submissions. And they identified 5 areas. Now, those 5 areas you will find in the JASA written submission. And I want to just give you the shortest possible overview of them, because they illustrate the point that I'm making, that it's essential that your committee considers these matters, fresh clauses dealing with these matters, in order to validate and make the 1996 Act, the principal act, work properly. First of all, counselling. We all know that Section 4 of the Principal Act says that the state shall promote counselling, and regulations have been made by Parliament pursuant to that section, and the regulations are quite specific.
I'm so sorry to disturb you.
That's all right.
Are you still dealing, or is this an additional point you are having outside what you have written in the submission?
No, I'm moving to counselling now, with Mr. Chairman, which is page 4 of my submission. What I've done in my submission, perhaps I ought to explain this, is using my experience of parliamentary drafting as a senior counsel from Britain, retired from Britain, I have attempted to draft clauses which could be put straight into this bill. Obviously, they will have to be considered by your parliamentary draftsmen and your legal advisers, but my submission is that these clauses could be used as they are in the bill. And that may be important, bearing in mind the fact that time is not, as has already been said, exactly on your side, bearing in mind the holiday break and the February deadline. So counselling is the first one. I'm not going to read through what I've drafted on page 4 and 5, and then there's in italics later on an explanation of why we need it. But I just want to say this very shortly, so that you see the nub of the point about counselling and the fact that it's not working. When the Act says, Section 4 of the Principal Act, the state shall promote counselling, the problem is that it does not place the onus on any particular person. And so many TOPs are done without any counselling or any adequate counselling at all. And of course that affects Section 5, the linchpin of the Act, informed consent. You can't have informed consent if the woman doesn't know what it's all about, if she hasn't been adequately counselled and hasn't had an opportunity to ask questions. So what we are proposing is that an amendment should be inserted into your bill which places the onus fair and square on the person administering the TOP, the health worker, whoever he or she is, the medical officer, the nurse or the midwife. That person has a duty either to do the counselling himself, herself, or a duty to ensure that it has been done already. That's a very simple amendment, but it's an essential one in our submission, because as the law stands, there is no clear duty placed on anyone, and as a result, the law is being ignored. Secondly, conscientious objection. Now, I'm not dealing with these matters in the order I put them in my submission. I'm dealing with them in the order that the Department of Health raised them. Conscientious objection. It's part of the rule of law, of course, enshrined in our Constitution. And when Parliament passed the Principal Act 10 years ago and more, it was said very specifically that a separate conscientious objection clause was not necessary because it was already provided for in the Constitution. But 10 years have passed, and 10 years have proved that that isn't working. All the time, health workers are being subjected to unfair discrimination and unfair pressure. They ring me up all the time. I had lunch with a doctor yesterday who was in deep distress about this. Simply to say, well, the Constitution covers the position is not adequate. In Britain, they have a conscientious objection clause. It's worked very well for 40 years. I think it's right to say that there has been only one piece of litigation concerning it. And I have put in my written submission that as recently as the 22nd of June, this is the bottom of page 10 of my written submission, 22nd of June, the Labour Court of Appeal, three judges, handed down a judgment which stressed the need for the Minister to provide certainty in this area of the law. That was the theatre sister case, the Charles case, which still hasn't been resolved after 3 years, when she was put under, harassed and put under extraordinary pressure to do something which was against her conscience. What better way, I would ask rhetorically, is there for the minister to provide certainty in this area of the law than for you to insert into this bill a conscientious objection clause? And I have drafted one, and it's there on page 10. Thirdly, the third area identified by the Department of Health was minors and informed consent. And it's right to say that, as with conscientious objection, the provincial legislatures felt very strongly about this. This came second, I think, only to conscientious objection in their negotiating mandates. To expect a 12-year-old to understand what she is doing, to understand the threefold risk which is now established when one has an abortion, psychological damage which may not show itself for 5 years, guilt, etc., difficulties in future births or even future conceiving, the ABC risk, now very much back in the headlines, the abortion breast cancer, known as the ABC risk. For a long time it was said no risk has been established, no link has been established. Now there's been a new piece of research just come out of the UK in the last month or so, which says very strongly that there is undoubtedly a link. You can't expect a 12-year-old or even a 15, 16-year-old to understand all this without parental help. One only has to make that a statement, really, to see that it's really quite wrong. We regard the family unit as so important. Guardians and parents are vital to the upbringing of children. And it just hasn't been working to say a child can go and get an abortion, be told, well, you ought to ask your parents if you feel like it, and of course she's caught in a terrible catch-22 situation. She doesn't want to. It just hasn't been working. And so JASA are proposing, as are others, that we have a provision that provides for the consent of at least one parent. In the exceptional case where that's not available, the judicial bypass, as it's described in the states, and it's working well in America, in most of the states, which simply means that there's a very cheap, easy way for the minor to go to a judge in chambers who will give his or her consent in the place of parents. And it will cost nothing if the legislation provides for that. And again, it's in our written submission. Fourthly, records of third trimester abortions. This is an extraordinary lacuna. And it's hard to see how anyone could object to a clause being included in the new bill which deals with this. It is mandatory for all first and second trimester abortions to be recorded, records kept, and they have to be filed with the Department of Health. Third trimester abortions, over 20 weeks, no records have to be kept. It's extraordinary. No records at all. So you can just wait to 20 weeks and do the most serious and most, to many people, reprehensible type of TOP and keep no record whatsoever. Now that's a lacuna which we suggest must be filled. The amendment is very short. My suggested draft is on page 11, paragraph 5. All one has to do is add one or two words to section 7.1 of the Principal Act to cure that defect. And then at least we will know what third trimester TOPs are taking place. The law permits them right up to full term. This is the most liberal law in the world, and we don't even know when they're being, how many are happening, and who's doing them. Finally, number 5, penalties. The Section 2 requirements of this Principal Act. The shortcomings have been highlighted by the Rose Clinic criminal case in Durban, where the staff pleaded guilty to over 2,000 offences of treating second trimester abortions just as if they were first trimester abortions, a doctor not being involved at all, the conditions required for second trimester and TOPs not being considered at all. And that's, we believe, and I've had access to the Doctors for Life records, which are kept in respect to this, that is the tip of the iceberg. It's happening all over the country. And so we submit that there must be tighter penalties where that happens. It's essential that the Constitution and the rule of law are to be upheld. It's essential that those who commit these offences can readily be brought to book. It was possible to bring them to book in the Rose Clinic case only by using the offence of conspiracy, because the Act doesn't provide the penalty for doctors who do this. It only provides penalties for other persons. So that needs to be attended to. And again, I have drafted suggested clauses at page 11 and 12. Now, the provincial parliaments, may I say this in closing, the provincial parliaments very properly took the route of considering all those five areas, and all of them submitted negotiating mandates saying that some at least of those five areas must be addressed in the bill. And, would you believe it, may I ask that, say that rhetorically, the NCOP threw them out lock, stock and barrel, which really turned the whole process in the provinces. Something approaching 100 public hearings, the expense, the time, the number of people involved, it turned that whole process into a sham. Hundreds and hundreds of citizens of South Africa, intelligent, hard-working, diligent citizens from all walks of life, attended those public hearings in the 9 provinces. Many worked very hard on their submissions, hours of hard work and sweat, drafting submissions. By and large, the provinces responded to them. They said they wanted additions made to the bill in response to those submissions, and the NCOP, for a reason that none of us could understand, slapped all those people in the face and refused to listen to the provincial legislatures. And the result is that the bill comes to you without one single amendment after how many hundreds of hours at those public hearings in the provinces. Gauteng refused to put in a final mandate. The other provinces did what they were told and put in final mandates without proposing any amendments. But Gauteng didn't do so. Well, now, they didn't give a reason, but I've read the minutes very carefully, and we may assume, I would respectfully suggest, that they simply refused to play along with the process that the NCOP had turned into a sham. And they said, if that's what you want, you just won't get a mandate from us. And they didn't put one in. Now, we in JASA have spent many, many hours drawing up these suggested clauses. In one sense, they're nothing new. They're simply upholding the rule of law in the Constitution in saying that it's essential that the checks and balances in the 1996 Act be complied with. We respectfully submit them to you, to this august House of Parliament, and ask you to take a different course to that taken by the NCOP. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir, for your submission. We shall provide an opportunity for honorable members to ask questions or get further elucidation of some of the points that may have been raised. Honorable members, we hand over the opportunity to yourselves. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for reading that. Thank you very much. Chair, let me thank the representatives from JASA for giving us the opportunity. I just want to correct to one thing, because whenever I study all the presentation throughout, it is written top. I don't know as well as he has been developing or we have already. We are dealing actually with a choice contamination of the process. And I just want to know from the presentation from JASA the as to whether I have wrote any judgment from the meaning of the Constitutional Court.
I didn't quite hear the question.
I just want to know as to whether, from your association, you don't actually erode. Thank you very much. Those who know.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Good technology, anyway. I just want to know as to whether you don't actually erode any facts being presented by the ruling of the Constitutional Court. That is number one. And if you are not actually trying to change anything, you are not even against any ruling of the Constitutional Court, because you have mainly based your facts when you present around the NCOP and the participation of the public. That is number one. And second to that is if there are any obstacles in relation to what you have been presenting, in relation to the bill, do you have... What is the main obstacles around the bill right now? And lastly, Chairperson, I just want the representation from JASA maybe to repeat one thing that he didn't say. It's within the presentation itself around, I wrote it down here. It was around counseling or whatever, because you have mentioned the fact that there are some other issues which are not actually within the bill right now. Thank you.
On the first point, of course we respectfully endorse and uphold the ruling of the Constitutional Court in every respect. And what we would say in respect of this bill is that the provinces, by and large, there have been a few complaints as to what happened in the provinces, but speaking generally, the provinces tried extremely hard to abide by the Constitutional Court ruling, and indeed, in many instances, the Eastern Cape particularly, where they had something like 40 hearings in the Eastern Cape alone, they perhaps went the extra mile many times over, and we commend them for that. But what we are concerned about, of course, is that the NCOP, when the matter came to the plenary session of the NCOP, they held no public hearings. And they have a duty to do so under Section 72 of the Constitution. And what's more, they rejected out of hand all the recommendations from the provinces. I think that was your first question, madam. You mentioned counselling. I don't think there's anything more I need to say about that. The crunch point is that the counselling, there are two really, the counselling must be adequate, and it's essential, as the regulations say at present, and this is already in the law, that the counselling should cover the areas of risk which a woman faces when she undergoes a TOP. And they're developing in scientific and medical knowledge all the time. But the other point, and perhaps the most important point, is that the burden of ensuring that counselling is done must be placed upon the shoulders of some particular person.
But the question was, the Honourable Member, and you keep on referring to termination. and you're leaving the most important operative word, choice. Was it conscious or just sheer perhaps carelessness in the presentation?
I think in my written submission the C is there.
Okay.
It is in the heading.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, two questions to the presenter. The first one regarding the keeping of records for the third trimester abortions. I hear what you're saying, but I've only been on the committee since June, so I may not know the ins and outs, but are third trimester abortions on demand only in specific cases? And if you could elaborate on that, you know, so you get an idea of the amount of abortions. And then the other issue around counselling, where you would like to make it mandatory counselling for women, have you given any thought or done any sums on the costing of the counselling, and who would pay for that? Thank you.
Thank you, sir. May I deal with the last point? The answer is we haven't done any sums on the costing, no. But I would submit from the little knowledge I have of this of the medical profession and the way that clinics work, that it shouldn't increase the costs dramatically for a health practitioner to spend 20 minutes with a patient talking about her choice before actually moving forward, particularly if graphic materials are provided and ready in the form of pictures or a video. It may be some of the time it can be taken up simply by asking the lady to watch a video, a DVD. I should bring myself up to date. It can be done, I think, in a simple way. And then there needs to be a time for questions. But again, I can't think that it would dramatically increase costs for the health profession or somebody in the health profession. It may well be a nurse to make sure that the lady's questions are answered and every opportunity is given to her to consider the matter. On the question of third trimester abortions, your first question, sir, what the Principal Act says, that after the 20th week of the gestation period, if a medical practitioner, after consultation with another medical practitioner or a registered midwife, in other words, there have to be two health workers, is of the opinion that the continued pregnancy, one, would endanger the woman's life, two, would result in a severe malformation of the fetus, or three, would pose a risk of injury to the fetus. Very difficult to understand what that means. If one or more of those conditions are fulfilled, then the pregnancy may be terminated. There's no upper time limit, so if two doctors or a doctor and a midwife decide that one of those conditions is fulfilled, even in the 38th week, the pregnancy can be terminated. Have I answered your question?
Just want to understand this. Why would you therefore assume, for instance, I think it says, during the period up to and including the 20th week of the gestation period of a pregnant woman is referred to, if this pregnancy continued to pose a risk or injury, there exists a substantial risk the future will suffer. And then it says after the 20th week, and then it proposes certain procedures. What would you assume then if it gives sort of an ad infinitum latitude for termination? What could be? I would suppose that any drafting is always reasonable.
Well,
it defines exactly what are the conditions after the 20th week.
After the 20th week of the gestation period must mean for the remainder of the gestation period. if a medical practitioner or two medical practitioners decide that's what they want it to mean and that's what the woman is advised and chooses, that's what it must mean. Of course, to many people and to many countries in the world, that's horrific. The upper limit in Britain is 24 weeks and they're talking about reducing it. But we don't have an upper limit.
But I'm saying to you, sir, it says after the 20th week of gestation period of a pregnant woman, referred to in subsection 4A and B. So A and B, 4A and B then says severe mentally disabled in a state of continuous unconsciousness. So it's not just giving a... It refers to a particular condition. So it's not just a laissez-faire, as I'm saying. It refers to a condition above subsection 4A and B. And it defines subsection as 4A and B. So those are the conditions the woman faces at that particular point in time.
So I think probably, sir, we're at cross purposes. I'm looking at section 2 of the Principal Act, and I believe you're reading from section 5, the part which deals with...
after the 20th week, that was the section you were reading.
Yes, but yes. This deals only, I think, with a woman who is severely mentally disabled. So that's a very special case. What you were reading deals with the case of a woman who is severely mentally disabled and is completely incapable of understanding. I was dealing with the general case where that is not so, where the woman can give her consent.
I didn't follow you, sir.
I'm sorry? I'm so sorry.
I can't understand what you are trying to say.
I'm saying that I'm right, am I not, that you were reading from section 5 of the Principal Act,
yes,
which deals, and B, it deals with a pregnant woman referred to in 4A or B, which is somebody who is mentally disabled or in a state of continuous unconsciousness, where obviously special considerations have to apply. I'm dealing with the general case. In answer to your colleague's question, I'm dealing with the general case of the woman who can give consent to a third trimester TOP after 20 weeks.
But even there, it says, after the 20th week, if a medical practitioner, after consultation with another medical practitioner or the registered midwife, is of the opinion that the continued pregnancy would endanger, cause severe malfunctioning, would pose a risk. It gives certain definitions.
Correct.
So it's not something that's just giving any latitude. It defines exactly what are those things. So that's why I'm saying that it's specific.
Certainly, sir, you're absolutely right with respect. All that we are contending for here is that in those very special circumstances, records ought to be kept. The doctors involved ought to be required to write down which condition of the three conditions you've read out, which of those applies in that case, and those records ought to be part of the records and statistics which are kept by the Department of Health. So if we're having a very late termination of pregnancy, we at least ought to have statistics which indicate how many are taking place and what are the reasons for them, what are the conditions under the Act.
So they are specialists here better than me. You are therefore saying those records, this clause is necessary because the present law does not require any records to be kept of a third trimester abortion.
Correct, sir.
What is third trimester abortion? Is there such a thing?
A third trimester is after 20 weeks. So if you go to section 7 of the Principal Act, you will see where, which is entitled Notification and Keeping of Records, you will see that section 21C, which is third trimester TOPs, is excluded. Section 7.1 only deals with 2.1A and 2.1B. So, that
thank you, Chair. No, we do not have such a thing called a third trimester abortion. A third trimester traditionally meant from 28 weeks onwards. That is the third trimester. However, in the South African law, with the Principal Act, it was recognized that from about 22, 24 weeks, there's a likelihood of the fetus to be viable. Therefore, under the Act, it says that anything above 20 weeks, that a record has to be kept off under the births and deaths registration. So every birth above 20 weeks of 500 grams must be registered, and a certificate has to be issued, whether it was a stillbirth or whether it was a live birth and died soon thereafter. So that's what the current law and the current practices are in South Africa. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I just want a clarity here. I thought we are dealing with amendments as on B21 of 2007. I am not sure what the presenter has just presented to us, whether that falls within the ambit of the bill that we are supposed to discuss this morning. If I can be clarified on this. Because to me it seems introduction of new amendments.
Thank you, madam. May I simply read again what the Constitutional Court has said, or the part which I have put, the words which I have put in italics at page 2 of the JASA submission. The court says that legislators must have the benefit of all inputs that will enable them to produce the best possible laws. And all our submissions are designed to produce better laws.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to understand very well what the presenter was explaining to us, because I did understand that he did a lot of comparative studies, and coming here back home, I thought he could also have done some little surveys around what happened since the Principal Act, so that when comparing whatever he's trying to bring in with the new clauses, which according to me are not based compared to what is actually happening here, because we have instances which we can pinpoint and improve and amend our act based on our very own experiences, because looking at what happened after the introduction of this act, what needs to be done after it on improving service delivery, because we are here talking about people who demographically we know never had any facilities and died because of that backyard abortions. And after this, the introduction of the Principal Act, what happened that we should improve on, not necessarily look at what happened in the first world countries and try to improve our own acts upon. And our counseling, really, even if we have to, we must look at other things that suit us, because I'm totally not for the idea of taking a person who has chosen to come for advice and show him all those graphics instead of talking to a person and trying to respond to what he's putting on you and bringing in new issues that will divert him from what he had actually thought was his right when coming to request assistance. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to have clarity on ABC, that is abortion, breast cancer. What may be the causes of developing breast cancer after abortion? Is it maybe of the drugs that are used when performing this procedure?
I'm not a doctor, so treat what I say, madam, with some caution. But as I understand the position, it's this. As the breasts develop so that they can provide lactation, if that process of development in the breasts is suddenly interrupted and violently interrupted by a TOP, then it is that violence done to the natural processes of development in the breasts which can increase the risk of breast cancer. But there will be doctors, I think, making submissions after me. There's one sitting behind me, and he will be able to enlarge on that, I'm sure.
A woman who has had the termination may necessarily therefore report, in the process of that report, what are the other medical conditions that person had. Would that not be necessarily the case, and therefore an assumption then carried to assume this breast cancer? What is this medical evidence? Where is the research you base yourself, you base this assertion? Where is the research that we can accurately say? I mean, you have not identified even one reference research done anywhere to make this argument. It's just said and concluded as such. And of course, I mean, we should be informed.
Chairman, I think this is a matter for the doctors. I have looked at the research which has been done in many countries in the world, America, UK, New Zealand particularly. I'm responsible for a case which is coming to trial in due course in Durban, which relates to a schoolgirl who underwent a TOP at the age of 18, and we are proposing to call an expert from overseas to give evidence about these matters. So I have looked at it in some detail, but I haven't included in my submission a whole mass of statistics and medical reports. It may be that others will, but I felt that would be too much. After all, as you have pointed out, we're not concerned today as to whether there should be TOPs in South Africa. We're simply concerned. We got onto this simply on the question of keeping records.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just wanted actually to ask the same question, just like Honorable Gabini, because when you go and do a mammography, it's called mammography, the screening of cancer or breast cancer or what if you, I think it's called like that. They will tell you that, because I don't want us to be given an information which will not assist, or the information which would tell other people not to exercise their rights. For instance, I didn't breastfeed, And one day when I did that thing, I'm going to cite my own example. That nurse said to me, because you didn't breastfeed, you can develop a breast cancer along the way. That is why I'm saying we need not to go out when discussing this choice of top and send other messages which are not tested, just like what the chairperson has been saying, Chair. Second to that is around the issue of counseling, because it has been mentioned in your presentation. I just want to know as to whether there are any conflicts between the Principal Act and your presentation in relation to counseling right now. Thank you, Chair.
The conflict, the major conflict, madam, is this, that the Principal Act says the state shall promote counseling. But the Act does not put the burden of ensuring that the counseling is done upon any individual. And therefore, it is frequently ignored. If you provide in legislation a general duty, and everybody is able to say, oh, but it doesn't say I've got to do it, then it may be that nobody does it. It's tempting to say, but I'm not sure one ought to joke about these things in this context, everybody's baby is nobody's baby. But you know that expression, and that's what it means. When you put a duty on everybody, then people say, well, if it's not me, it must be the next person. The nurse says, well, I assume that when this lady came into emergency or into casualty, she was counseled there, or when she went to her general practitioner. It's easy just to pass the buck.
A follow-up, please, Chair.
Questions regarding the registration of abortions after 20 weeks. If I hear what the department's saying, that those abortions are then registered on the death and birth register, but it still doesn't help as far as identifying how many abortions are taking place after 20 weeks. And the register still won't identify, as far as I know, so maybe the department can clarify this, which are the conditions which used to justify the abortion after 20 weeks? Because there's three set out in the law, as you read out, and I think it makes sense that there is a register to determine how many abortions are taking place after 20 weeks and what was the justification. Because I'm sure that the birth and death register will just say it's stillborn, I'm sure, and won't even say it's an abortion while the baby was stillborn. So I think that's the one point, but maybe the department can clarify. Then the other issue around counselling, I mean, I would also like to find out, I mean, is it the norm around the world where abortion is legal, that counselling takes place, first of all? And secondly, I hear maybe some of the concerns from members whereby if it was mandatory and every woman had to go for counselling beforehand, that you probably, depending on the medical practitioner concerned, you could have a pro or anti bias if it was left up to the individual. So, I mean, you could easily have one set, what's the word I'm looking for? Presentation. where it's used throughout the country. So it's a new, if I can put the use the word, a neutral presentation where practitioners cannot influence either for or against abortion, and it's certified by the Department of Health. You know, to me that would make perfect sense. I mean, would that fall in line with your thinking or not? Thank you, Jeff.
Yes, thank you very much, sir. It seems to me that that is an excellent proposal. What I didn't touch on this morning is the more detailed drafting of the clause in the Principal Act. The state shall promote the provision of non-mandatory and non-directive counselling before and after the termination of a pregnancy. Now, those words have caused tremendous difficulty. That's why we're proposing they should be replaced. Non-mandatory sounds as if, well, it's not necessary to have counselling. I don't think Parliament intended it to mean that. I think Parliament intended it to be, well, you don't tell a woman, you don't direct her, you don't mandate her as to what she's to do. The non-mandatory and non-directive go together. But of course, many practitioners or persons say, well, if it's non-mandatory, we don't have to do it. Non-directive, I think, obviously covers your situation where you don't want bias in the council. But certainly we would support provision of counselling which is done by an independent body. I think it mustn't be the Department of Health or the state. It mustn't be private practitioners. There needs to be, as of course there are, many bodies which provide independent counselling and non-biased counselling. On the other point, may I say that it's one learns something new every day, and I didn't realise till I heard this morning what the Department of Health had to say, that the omission of records for what we all loosely call third trimester abortions, above 20 weeks, the omission of keeping records was deliberate. I thought it was a mistake. But now we know it wasn't a mistake. It was because there is the births and deaths register. But I would not add anything to what you've said. I mean, it's essential we have a register which provides, which says, well, this was a TOP, it wasn't just a death, and the condition in the Act under which it fell.
Your page 4 of the submission versus what you argue is a problem with the Principal Act and related also to the point Honorable Matsi Mela was raising for you to identify what are these conflicts. Now, you see, that was the point also Honorable Waters is raising here, that there are potential dangers which you must address with regards to counseling, that it must be in such a way that your subjectivity to your views is not actually done in such a way that you either subconsciously or consciously discourage a person to either do or not do. You see, that's the point is actually raising. Now, if one reads your page 4, and we then, as a committee, go along with your proposal, already you are then saying that your counseling must tell the person that it is wrong to go for the termination of pregnancy. I mean, I don't want to read and waste your time again. If one reads, that's why the Principal Act is quite clever. It says that you shall promote the provision of non-mandatory and non-directive, so that your subjectivity here is subsumed by what is objectively required by the person presenting to you as a registered midwife or as a doctor to say, this is what I want to be carried. Now, what we are suggesting here, already these are the dangers, potential dangers, risk of breast cancer, and we have not been convinced thus far of any research presented to us that your assertion on this issue is correct. Our view is that it may not be, But you have not given us any research or reasonable arguments around this particular issue. Questions of depression, that's a very subjective question. Depression can happen even with just a simple issue that happens every day, sickness or death. But are you going to say it's wrong to die when people are going to die objectively? You see, the risk of difficulty in conceiving and bearing children in the future. I don't think medical, I'm sure there are a lot of eminent doctors that are here. I don't think medical necessarily, if you conduct terminal pregnancy, necessarily you're not going to be reproducing in the near future, in the future. That's really, to me, not a point that can really convince me. Can you see now the point that you are raising here? Whereas here, it says it must be non-directive and non-mandatory. Now, your own submission actually falls into the very problem when our water says we should guard against a particular issue. The other point relates further to the point Honorable Waters was raising. Have you considered the cost? If you then say you outsource this counseling outside, have you considered the cost to the state? Because if you outsource, then it means you must employ other people outside. That's the point is actually raising. These are the problems we're finding with your submissions. Honorable Dudley, I think I'm going to take the last two questions that we're going to move.
Thank you. I'll just link to that, just to get clarity in terms of what you're suggesting, that risks are pointed out. And just to ask you, my understanding of what you said would be that, for example, I had some cracked vertebrae, and it was suggested that I need an operation. Now, that doctor wasn't trying to tell me I should have it or not have it, but trying to lay out all the facts. And a part of those were that I could be one out of 20 people whose vocal cords get cut while you're doing it. And then I would never have again, which would have been fun for the health committee, who wouldn't have had a voice. And that wasn't, he still very much felt that if it was him, he would have had that operation. But you still have to understand what the risks are. Now, I obviously have read those the research that's been done around the breast cancer and the depression and things, and those can be given to the committee if needed. So are you really basically saying, just as with any other medical procedure, the risks have to be clearly stated, even if it's a minimal risk, if it's a large risk, and people have to, so that people can make their own decision knowing? Because I'm sure the chair is not suggesting that we cover up those risks, because then, I mean, obviously doctors normally would then be liable for being sued, which of course should happen here if this, and could happen here. In fact, it's putting doctors at risk as far as I'm understanding. Could you comment on those things?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think the point here is, building on that, that there is already legislation which says that counselling shall include telling the woman the procedure and the associated risks of the termination of her pregnancy. We tend to overlook the regulations which have been made under the Principal Act, but they, of course, have the same force of law as the Principal Act. So we already have very clear legislation. May I just remind the committee of this, because so often we don't look at the regulations. Regulation 7 says, counselling in terms of Section 4 of the Act shall at least include sufficient information to assist a woman to make an informed choice regarding the termination of her pregnancy. B, a woman requesting the termination of her pregnancy shall be informed during counselling with regard to 1, the available alternatives to the termination of her pregnancy, adoption or whatever. 2, the procedure and the associated risks of the termination of her pregnancy. And 3, contraceptive measures which can be taken in the future. Now, therefore we have legislation which says the patient, the woman, must be told of the associated risks. In practice, this doesn't happen, and therefore we are proposing that the recognized risks should at least be mentioned. Of course they mustn't be exaggerated. Of course there are only risks. As Mrs. Dudley says, it's 1 in 20 or maybe 1 in 1,000. I don't know. But if the legislation says, as it does say at the moment, that she must be told of the associated risks, then she must be told. And these are the recognized risks in the medical profession, and I'm sure others will confirm that.
Honourable Matumisa.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to find out from JAFA on the issue of consent. You made mention of the fact that a 12-year-old who is pregnant needs a consent from her parents or guardians. But what if the parents or guardians refuse to give consent for her to terminate pregnancy? Can she exercise her own right?
We submit that it would be very unlikely that both parents would refuse to give consent for no good reason. If, of course, there's a good reason, then the process has to be taken further and you go back to the doctor. That's why my proposed clause, pages 5 and 6, is rather lengthy. It's difficult to set it out shortly. There has to be a process. But in the extreme case, which is often quoted, where a girl perhaps with a mother who's much in love with a stepfather and she's been raped by her stepfather, one of these terrible cases, and that's produced a pregnancy, well then there has to be a way out for her, and that is the judicial bypass. That's been well proven in other countries in the Western world, that you provide a system where for at no cost a minor can go and see a judge privately, confidentially, and he can provide what's called a judicial bypass.
Honourable members, I think we've entertained, I think, by and large, the submissions from Justice Alliance of South Africa. Try to solicit as much information from the presenter, John Smith Chusi, and I would suggest that we move forward and take the next submission here, and thank Mr. Smith here for the information provided and some of the views that he advanced. We then go to just to, for your information in the future, Mr. Smith, you may well be aware that in terms of the separation of power, sometimes people always never understand this. We pass legislation. The executive, in the implementation of the legislation, then develop regulations in consultation with the stakeholders broadly, and they are given certain time frames. I'm sure you should know this by now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, so much, and for giving me such ample time. I'm grateful.
Doctors for Life, that's why you were eating, sir, Mr. Tsidiso Ngwebe. Not Mr. Sorry, Doctor. Dr. Tsidiso Ngwebe. Sorry?
No.
Follow the chair, what the chair says. There's a wisdom why the chair would actually do that. Because the other copies are being made, but just take my bona fides as I move forward. In terms of, thank you very much. Now, where's the...
it is it one thing? Near the one thing that is for life.
Yes. Thank you very much. The women therapy, women therapy, successfully, Dr. Jenny Bambu, I think they are busy copying the submission. Well, that's all. Thank you very much. Oh, okay, thank you very much. So, let's get Dr. Salai in the country to women research.
Thank you, Chairperson. Speaking is Dr. Nkwebe, I'm representing Doctors for Life International. Just a bit of background for everyone. Doctors for Life represents 1,400 plus medical professionals, including specialists. We operate a 24-hour helpline for medical professionals who often find themselves in very difficult situations, including legal difficulties. We also have other projects that include Life Child, where we look after orphans that have been born into some of the social ills that we are all aware of. We also have other projects such as a 24-hour helpline for pregnancy crisis. So, Chairperson, just that background to show that we aren't really ignorant of the difficulties that we are sitting discussing. Personally, I've worked in both urban and rural hospitals, so I have experienced the kind of situations that patients face in both settings. May I just say, Chairperson, as Doctors for Life, we are rather alarmed and disheartened at what has just happened, where essentially, if I may say, the NCOP passed this the law without considering the kind of submissions and the public hearings that took place in all the provinces. We are really concerned, and we are actually wondering about how constitutional this process has been, given that in fact the majority of people who made submissions, it seems like the submissions have been ignored. With that in mind, Chairperson, I would just humbly just like to ask if the committee would just seriously take light or take note of the following considerations or the following submissions. The first one is centering around conscientious objection. Chairperson, we believe conscientious objection is a healthcare worker's right. It's a constitutional right. Conscientious objection, we don't believe, is an option. We find it stipulated in the Constitution that anybody who works, who is a professional, who is employed in this country, has a right not to be discriminated against based on their conscience. Healthcare workers are not an exception. Chairperson, we found, hopefully these examples will help to illustrate the point. Countries such as the United Kingdom, Australia, the various territories of Australia, Denmark, and other countries, not just internationally, they all have clauses, conscientious objection clauses in their legislation that deals with termination of pregnancies. And South Africa, having such a liberal constitution, I do not see why, Chairperson,
South Africa should now deny healthcare workers of their basic right. Not just internationally, let me quote some local examples. Organizations such as SAMA and DENOSA have explicitly voiced their support that a conscientious objection clause must be in this choice of termination of pregnancy amendment bill 21 of 2007. It is not a hidden, or it is not an unknown fact, Chairperson, that the majority of healthcare workers in this country, if you were to take a poll, you will not find it difficult to find out that the majority actually feel that an abortion, an arbitrary abortion, is killing an unborn child. That is just the way, the reality on the ground, sir. And despite all the submissions made from the provincial hearings, we find it really disturbing that nothing is mentioned about a conscientious objection clause, a basic right for healthcare workers. So we are recommending that a conscientious objection clause really ought to be in this act. The second point, Chairperson, is on the designation of the choice of termination of pregnancy facilities. With regard to this, it's rather, and you will see it in the written submission, they are what are called government-appointed or designated areas, termination of pregnancy areas, which we find difficult in understanding what the logic behind how they are designated, Chairperson. We often find, let me quote an example, a personal example. I work in an institution where the number of pro-life or anti-abortion, anti-terminating of pregnancy staff vastly outnumber those staff members which would support the facility being used as a termination of pregnancy facility. Yet, because the institution has a maternity and antenatal care facility and a minimum number of staff who are willing to partake in terminating pregnancies, the facility is then designated. We see this as generating a set of dilemmas, because firstly, the public is led to assume or understand that a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week service for choice of termination of pregnancies is now made available at this facility, yet the staffing is questionable. How, Chairperson, is such a facility going to serve that public when it is not even properly staffed to run adequately? Chairperson, let me put in another issue, the use of misoprostol, which I think we are all pretty fairly familiar with. The use of misoprostol will complicate this issue, because what often happens, not as an exception but rather as a rule, what happens is misoprostol, a patient is given misoprostol, and then she is told, she's often given this misoprostol outside hospital setting. And then this lady, who, if we are to face facts, are usually minimally educated, often not literate. So they are at the mercy of the healthcare worker who hands them these tablets. They are told, once you see bleeding, go to your nearest hospital, and the following is told to these patients, then they will perform the rest of the procedure. This will introduce a dilemma, Chairperson, because here now you have a set of healthcare workers, most of whom are not in favor of carrying out termination of pregnancies as a conscientious choice. Yet
you have a flood of patients who themselves cannot be blamed for this. They themselves have been handed tablets under the guise that once they reach a hospital, the procedure will be done. Yet the amount of staff that are available to do the procedure is not adequate. Not only that, there is a perception that has been created that where a hospital has maternity antenatal facilities, automatically there will be a termination of pregnancy facilities. This will also generate dilemmas for healthcare workers who it seems we are heading to a point where they will be forced, even those that do not wish for conscientious reasons, even those that do not wish to partake in them, they will be forced to complete termination of pregnancies. We find this as a huge problem, which can actually potentially draw litigation against the government. We would like to recommend, in light of this, Chairperson, that maternity and antenatal care facilities in all hospitals be separated from the places where the choices of termination of pregnancies are done. They must be completely separated. Not only so, but we would like to recommend that before a facility is designated as a choice of termination of pregnancy facility, proper research must be done regarding how it is going to be staffed, not just for the short term, but for the long term. The third point, Chairperson, I'd like to go to is around what I stress informed consent. It centers around informed consent. We find this as a particularly important issue because informed consent is actually a patient's constitutional right. Chairperson, I've just been hearing prior to when you corrected me, and I thank you for the correction, hearing various speakers comparing the choice that a lady has in deciding to terminate her pregnancy with, for an example, mammography. And as a demonstration of my point, I would like to add that the consequences of those two procedures are vastly different. They are not the same. And I'd like to submit, therefore, that it is actually an unfair comparison to make. Chairperson, we believe that proper counseling must be done in order for the lady not to be biased towards a one particular way or the other. Proper counseling must be done at the level of the lady, and we see this. I see this daily in the facility I work in, where proper counseling must be done at her level, at where she will understand it, where she can be brought to the place where she can at least subjectively say, I understand this and this and this risk. I understand that this and this is what is, it may or may not happen to me. And I still decide to carry on with the procedure, or I know, do not decide to carry on with the procedure. This, Chairperson, is what we see as being proper informed consent. And my personal experience is it does not happen on the ground. Patients are being inflicted with, as I mentioned, take the tablet. When you get to the hospital, they will continue, they will finish, the healthcare workers will complete the procedure. There are certain risks that are known medically, Chairperson, that have been researched. The research continues, but they are known so far that they do happen in a certain number of cases of ladies who have had termination of pregnancies. It is imperative then that these, our patients, also be informed that they may fall within that percentage in whom the complications will occur. It is their basic right to know that. But it is not happening on the ground. We would like to therefore
to stipulate, and as a recommendation, Chairperson, that consent or informed consent, it must be stipulated in this act. Excuse me. It must be stipulated in this act, and it is not there, Chairperson. It must be stipulated precisely what information must be provided to the patient. Exactly how it must be provided, even if we have to bring it down to her language, it must be stipulated. It is not happening currently, in my personal experience. We see this, in fact, as her constitutional right. Lastly, Chairperson, my last point will just be about abortion and minors. There was a previous point made in light of this, that what happens in the social, the very frequent social problems and the ills that we live in, where a child is unable to obtain consent from their guardian or parent. Unfortunately for us, and this places all of us as a society in a difficult position, unfortunately, child psychology objectively has shown that minors are incapable of understanding the consequences of their decisions, and this is the critical point. Anybody can make a decision. The key is that child psychologists have shown that minors cannot understand the consequences of their decisions, especially reproductive decisions. And that is where the key lies. It is not in her just making the choice. It lies in whether she understands the consequences of her choice. That is what we are really dealing with here. Minors cannot understand the consequences of their choices. They can make choices, but they don't understand the consequences. It is important, Chairperson, that this is understood by the committee before allowing or inflicting children with the burden of having to understand the likelihood of developing major depression after terminating her pregnancy. I am the father of a girl. It would really, really be a shocking, and I would grow nervous by the day as she gets older, thinking that I am heading towards a point where she will become 12 years old, suddenly look me in the face and say she wants to have a TOP. She falls pregnant and she now wants to have an abortion. And I know she cannot understand when I describe to her that she can perforate the uterus and never fall pregnant, that she can die. I know she does not understand when I say she may have post-traumatic stress disorder. She does not understand that. That is the possible consequences of her decision. So we'd like to recommend, please, Chairperson, that our children be protected they must be a clause that will protect children from termination of pregnancies. And the way to do that would be children must have supervision, either by their parents or their guardians, legal guardians. Thank you.
For your submission. We shall then, honored members, open to members to ask questions. Honorable Mashiko.
Thank you, Chairperson. In the Principal Act, it is stated that in the case of a pregnant minor, a medical practitioner or a registered midwife shall advise the such a minor to consult her parents or guardian or family member. And I wonder if there need to be any more this sachet law still needs to be modified. That's what I'd like to ask the doctor. And again, this issue of conscientious, what do you call it, objection, is really a one that needs to be debated, because much as there need to be some objective objections, I think when people go in to be trained as health practitioners, there are some conditions through which they know they'll go. I'm not against what you're saying, but having they taken an oath to say that I will be able to do such a work, or the knowledge of the exposure of their work, didn't it inform them about of the type of work that they'll be doing? Thanks very much, Chair.
Dr. Mbwebe?
Thanks, Chairperson. In the principal, if I can deal with the first question first, Chairperson. In the Principal Act, as far as I remember, as you read, clearly outlines that there needs to be proper medical substance. In other words, like you say, the healthcare workers in consultation look at the condition that the minor is undergoing, and they have to consult the minor's guardian or parents. And that we don't have a problem with. What we have a problem with is introducing the decision-making responsibility to a minor without the parent's or the guardian's consent. That we have a serious problem with. For not because we are parents, but because, as I've just said, it is child psychology that shows that minors cannot understand the consequences of those decisions. So if in the Principal Act it stays like that, I do not see us having any problems. Secondly, excuse me, I agree with you, madam. Medical doctors, nurses are taught and they are trained about terminating pregnancies and in various situations, even at various stages. But you need to understand that there is a central figure, there is a central point that the whole issue revolves around that cannot be separated from it. This issue is, and it is still an ongoing debate, you must first answer the question, that which you are saying a woman can abort, or that which you are saying you are being trained to terminate, what is it? You will find most scientific journals will say it is a full human being with all the potential of a human being. Unfortunately, for most people, that brings in a conscientious decision. It is not something that, madam, it is not something that we generated. Scientific journals have shown repeatedly, and there are some that are quoted in the submission, they show repeatedly that a human life has been shown to begin at conception. That brings in a conscientious decision. A healthcare worker, whether they are being trained and whether they like going through the training or not, and we all do go through the training, as they go through the training, it brings in those tensions and they cannot be separated. It is a conscientious dilemma, but you go through the training. The dilemma remains with you. A lot of healthcare workers carry that with them. But it cannot be, the training is stipulated, and I dare say it is some of the best in the world. But it does not separate that there is a conscientious decision that the healthcare worker is now faced with, because life begins at conception. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a contested view. I'm sure you would know that. I'm sure generally the very point you are raising, that's a contested view. There may be places where it says that particular view. People, there may be people who may have other definitions. So I really want us to let's leave that one because it's going to divert us. Let's just come back to this issue of the minor so that we can just see how we understand you. Maybe a departure point, I'm sure you have actually said you work both in rural and urban areas. And I'm sure in your interaction you have now come to realize, and I think there's enough evidence currently we've been dealing with in the committee in various, at various levels, that children as young as 12 years old engage into certain sexual activities. It's an undisputed fact. Am I right? Therefore, the dangers of unplanned pregnancies may emerge, given some of the arguments we are actually raising. In such situations, therefore, Dr. Ngwebe, it may therefore happen that a child of 11 years, for some reasons of ignorance or adventure, falls pregnant. And there's a view that by the child, given the future that can be hampered by that child, that this was not the pregnancy I wanted. I want to do away with it. Are you suggesting that we deny that opportunity, sir?
Thank you for the question, Chairperson. Let me start by saying, reiterating as I did at the beginning, that we understand completely the kinds of difficulties and dilemmas you are quoting. I have just dealt with one such a few weeks ago, where a young girl was raped by her father and she fell pregnant. And in her pregnancy, and among all the other difficulties that we know she will experience throughout her life, we are now faced with what to do. It is a difficult position to live in. And we see them on the ground, sir, every day. So we are not separate. We are not separating ourselves from the pain of that people go through when we have to deal with this. But what we have to please not run away from is that some of the social ills that bring about the scenario that you articulate, unfortunately, sir, won't be solved when we then put the decision to the child that she can terminate the pregnancy. Not only that, but us giving that child that responsibility does not mean she understands the consequences of what she is choosing. We just have to face that. It isn't something that we generated as Doctors for Life. Now, if we have these social ills, perhaps then our energies, even today, need to be focused at what is wrong with the men who rape children. And it is another whole day's and whole year's debate. Perhaps we need to then be properly thinking about where must our energies be focused at when men are raping babies. We need to be careful to know what it is that the termination of pregnancy is solving in a minor who got raped. What exactly are we attempting to solve? Are we brushing aside a problem for the short term, which may underneath and underground generate a longer term problem that we may not control in the future? This is the problem. It is a severe tension and a pain that we live in. But we cannot depart from what is factually known. Minors cannot understand the consequences of their decisions. And this is why we can't depart from saying a guardian, a parent must be involved. Thank you.
This section, I've recognized, Matumise, But just for me to further, I'm not going to come into that particular debate. I'm sure you understand. I think objectively, things happen outside there. And whether you address which one first, both will happen outside there. I think that's an objective life. And this is the moral decay that we're facing every day. And I think that's an objective reality that I'm sure all of us here, we live and grow up in this community and we see these things. That's why when we deal with this, sometimes we subsume some of our subjective feelings to deal with what is objectively facing society and deal with them in that context. Let me leave that for now and come back to the principal act here. I just want to understand where are the remedies you seek to put, as I'll head over quickly to Honorable Dumisi, you perhaps try to think. It says, in the case of a pregnant minor, a medical practitioner or the registered midwife, as the case may be, shall advise such minor to consult with her parents, guardian, family members, or friends before the pregnancy is terminated. Provided that the termination of the pregnancy shall not be denied because such a minor chooses not to consult them. I just want to understand what actually we are trying to say, as opposed to what is actually presented. Is of course, I've just looked very carefully into your own submission with regards to these things. Honorable Dumisi?
Yes.
I just want to give you time to think about it.
Mine is on minors, as clearly said by Dr. Nkwebe, that they make choices but do not understand the consequences of their decisions. Now, what I want to understand is, if this 12-year-old carries on with her pregnancy, will she then, or how will she understand the consequences of bringing up that particular child that she did not plan for?
Thanks, Shepherd. With regard to your question, Chairperson, if I may be given some more time to think about it, may I respond to madam's question? It is a hard question, and it is a dilemma. And I think difficult dilemmas such as the one you are voicing boil us down to the basic ethics that have to drive us. And I think before you or I make a decision about such a scenario, perhaps we both need to ask ourselves, and we both privately need to be able to answer the question, that which we are saying the minor can abort, what is it? I could answer the question to myself, and you would answer the question to yourself. The answer to that question will help us to judge which consequences we would advise the minor. Were we in that situation, they would help us decide which choices we would advise her, or we would say she would take if it were, for example, our own children. The answer to that fundamental question is more important because it will help us to judge which consequences we are willing to face.
Thank you very much, Honorable Dudley.
Thanks. I wanted to ask, as the law stands, is it adequate to protect a child who's being manipulated or abused by an adult? And should there be an onus on either the facility or the person performing the TOP to report a possible statutory rape, as we're discussing the age of this child?
Thanks for the question. As a medical, as a doctor, we are actually mandated, we have to, at the slightest hint, not just at the point where the young child has fallen pregnant, at the slightest hint that there might be even a suspicion that there is abuse of any kind, we have to start the process. We actually have to. So by all means, at the point where you are now discussing, where there is now a termination of pregnancy happening, by then, long before, we should have started the process of investigating, finding out if there has been abuse and taking action about it. We are mandated to do so. We have to. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. What I would really appreciate about the presentation is the fact that they've made a mention of the constitutional court ruling, which is very, very fundamental in our discussion, that indeed the NCOP didn't conduct public hearings in relation to what the public has to do. And secondly, on that chair, it's on page immediately after their letter signed by the CEO on the following page. Conscientious objection. Chairperson, maybe one need to cite this example, that sometime last year we went out to do an oversight. Unfortunately, we went to do an oversight around one of the clinics around Cape Town. Michael Mapungwani, or what community health care. When we arrived there, indeed, we've been told about the challenges on health workers not volunteering or not choosing to go and help the doctor who's present. It means, in their conscience, if they don't want to do that, it is within their right, the health workers. If they don't want to do that, it is within their right. Why is it today being mentioned that some of them are victimized and what have you? Knowingly understanding that in this country, there are labor laws. There are unions in this country, and we have never had one day Nehau or Denosa making a mention that healthcare workers have been victimized because of refusing to be part or to participate in CTOP and the like. And the very same page, Chair, under section 15.1, which says the CTPA is very controversial in its very nature and disregards and the like the sentences. By then, I think, prior to 1994, I would wonder as to whether it was not controversial, this CTOP, because the abilities and capabilities have been given to a certain group of healthcare workers. But today we are saying it is very controversial. What are this in essence, Chairperson, when other people are given their own right being mentioned in the presentations again to exercise, because it is a choice again. If a nurse is willingly want to do this, it's out of her choice again to help other a doctor or what have you. And the understanding, the scenario at this Michael Mapungwana, we've been briefed because we sat down with the doctor who's performing the whole thing. We were placed as the committee that at least each and every little step in terms of the Principal Act has been followed in that clinic. It's within the township. And we have seen, because some people have made a consent that I don't have a problem to be interviewed by members of the committee and to see as to what is actually happening there. Three nurses were there participating with the doctor who has been doing that. But lastly, Chair, I just want to say Doctors for Life International has made so many recommendations. I don't know at the end of the day how to fit in these recommendations in relation to the amendment of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Let me start, if I may, Chairperson, with the first issue. what drives us as a civil organization, for example, is yes, we see the written law that has been written down, but because we are made of professionals who work on the work at, as for example I do, what we see is, for example, madam, the opposite of what you have just cited. You went to the one clinic you have quoted. We have heard and we hear on a day-to-day basis callers from everyone from nursing staff to doctors, theater sisters, all sorts of people who phone in daily and report issues of what they feel is discrimination. There are various examples I could use where, in light of a choice that a certain sister or a doctor, an intern, various healthcare professionals at various levels, in light of a decision that they take about from the position of their conscience about participating in choices of termination of pregnancy procedures, they become, in a very true sense, victims of discrimination because they are pressurized. They are told they are cop-outs, I'm quoting from actual reports we have received. They are told they are cop-outs and they are dropping the load of, quote, work on everyone else. And based on the, and following that, at that very point is the beginning of discrimination. I don't know if there is disagreement about that. Now, it is unfortunate that we are receiving these reports, but we are receiving them. It means to us they are happening. Discriminations are occurring against staff that make conscientious decisions. We cannot ignore them, and they are not happening at one place. We can give you records of entire districts along KwaZulu-Natal, Free State, where I used to work, for example, where they have been reported on a day-to-day basis. Some of them have progressed to become legal court battles. Secondly, the issue of what happened before 1994. Firstly, subjectively, I was still a child, relatively speaking. So perhaps it is not appropriate for me to then answer you and tell you what was happening in light of this particular act. What I know is based on history that we often learn in the medical schools. And what I'm aware of is that the act was very, very tightly regulated. Yes, there was political tensions around how it was implemented and who was given the choices and the information to make the choices, and that is unavoidable. We've all come out of that, thank God. We've all come out of that. But it does not take away the basic principle or the underlying principle that we cannot then separate the issue of who had the information before to make the informed choices and who didn't. We cannot now say that the issue of, like I said earlier, you must answer the question, that which you are saying the woman has a right to abort, what is it? Answer that question first, and you will be able to judge which consequences you are willing to face. Thank you.
Charles, just to do with the conscientious objection, I was sitting here thinking if I was asked to perform, I mean, you know, something, if I were anti abortion, and if I were a doctor, if I was asked to perform an abortion, how would I react to it? Or anything else, I mean, just think of something else that you vehemently opposed to. How would you react to it? And I can understand why medical staff, some medical staff, refuse to do abortions. I really do. I mean, I can understand it because I have strong beliefs in certain aspects, you know, in my life. And if somebody asked me to do something that went against what I actually believe in the core of my existence, I certainly wouldn't do it. So I think, you know, you have a point there. But the question still, that question of the 12-year-old walking into the clinic or the hospital that needs an abortion, you know, that question still hasn't been answered. And everyone's quite right. The fact is, you know, the state should have intervened a long time before the child even got to the hospital being pregnant. And it boils down to the lack of social workers that we have in the country. And it's, you know, and I think the way many men treat women as well and perceive women. And that's a long-term solution. But you know, that question was very interesting. What do you do with a 12-year-old that comes into the hospital and wants an abortion? But I do take your point about the conscientious objection. The other point about designated facilities, where they want 24 hours, 7 day a week facilities, and you made the point that due to the lack of medical staff in the country, and we know there is a lack of medical staff, and the fact that many, I think you said majority, although we don't know, but let's say many of them would prefer not to perform abortions, but the fact is the health department could never guarantee there'd always be a pro-choice medical practitioner on duty at any given time. That's a point you're making, and therefore you said you wanted separate facilities. But and it's a question I'm going to pose to the department when we do interrogate them, Chair, is how are they going to ensure that they actually have staff 24 hours a day that are pro-choice on duty if they want to get this through? How are they going to do it? Because you have to recognise medical people's choice of not performing abortions. You have to, from my point of view anyway. And we say it's enshrined in the Constitution, so therefore it should be enforced and there shouldn't be a problem with that. So I would like the department to also answer that. And informed consent, in the third point, you mention the study and you say 100% of women suffer depression and you give a whole list. I mean, you don't get the title of the study, who conducted it, where it was conducted, etc. If you could give us more background on that particular study. Because, you know, I mean, just to say a study, I mean, anyone could then just give figures. So that's all my questions, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Mbali.
Thanks for the corrections. Please accept my apologies. There should have been perhaps footnotes about where these numbers are quoted from and how old the studies are. You know, that's relevant to how relevant, I mean, how much weight you can place on the numbers. So my apologies. I can provide the committee with those references. To everything else, I really don't, unless you could repeat the questions, but I think it was more comments.
Okay. Well, you see the problem, I think, as you are saying yourself, on conscientious objection, it's a new provision. It's, as you are saying, it's both not in the Principal Act, nor it is in the Amendment Act. It's a new provision that you are suggesting. And I'm sure by now, I know it's not the first time we deal with Doctors for Life. When we deal with amendments, You can't bring in new things. I'm sure you know that. I think we've dealt with you even in this legislation and in others in terms of dealing with Doctors for Life. The other question, I would have thought maybe in your submission, that's why it's always better for me when people make submissions, refer to the Principal Act, refer to the given amendment that is in front of us, and then can then make what you want to improve out of this. it helps us because that's where the power of public hearing is, you know, because that's where we improve our own weaknesses and the weaknesses of the discourse. Normal public hearings assist to improve the legislation. Because I've just been looking for the point Mark Waters, Honorable Mark Waters raises, in terms of the facilities. Both the Principal Act and the Amendment Act, even the Amendment Act, even more clear in terms of the number of these facilities, what is required, etc., etc. So, but we've listened to your submission, and I think I'm just worried about time. We're supposed then to get the Women's Health Research Unit, Dr. Jennifer Moodley, I'm not sure they are here. And then we break for lunch, honorable members, and come back after lunch. We were all invited to lunch. We'll be told where lunch is. Then we'll deal with the rest after lunch. Dr. Moodley, you're going to sit there or you sit where the honorable doctor is. I want to ensure that everybody is able to, you know, eye contact is always very good in dealing with these things. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is Jennifer Moodley. I'm a public health physician and I'm the director of the Women's Health Research Unit. In my early years as a clinician in the 1980s, I worked at King Edward VIII Hospital in KwaZulu-Natal. At that time, legal termination of pregnancy was available to very few women under very restricted conditions. It was at King Edward that I saw many, many women who, out of sheer desperation, had had a backstreet abortion. In the emergency unit, we would try desperately to help these women. Some survived, but many died, leaving behind family, loved ones, and young children. I realized then the importance of the practice of medicine, not only at an individual level, but also from a population-based perspective that would prevent such tragedies. This, amongst other injustices I witnessed, spurred me on to specialize in the field of public health and to become actively involved in efforts that would advance women's rights, that would increase their access to services, and ultimately that would improve women's health. I'm here today to present the views of the Women's Health Research Unit, which is based at the School of Public Health and Family Medicine in the Faculty of Health Sciences at the University of Cape Town. And I have two colleagues also involved in this area who are here with me today. The Women's Health Research Unit is involved in research, teaching, technical health service support and advocacy in the area of women's health. It is made up of a multidisciplinary team of researchers and conducts high-level research that is socially responsive and contributes towards understanding and addressing women's health problems. In an application to the Constitutional Court, it was declared that Parliament had erred by not facilitating public involvement prior to passing the Act. In response, the court mandated Parliament to rectify this situation by consulting with the public with regards to the amendment bill. This process is to be completed, as we heard, in February 2008. As a result of this mandate, the provincial legislature held public hearings in the nine provinces earlier this year. And today we continue with the hearings to the Parliamentary Committee on Health. The Women's Health Research Unit supports the Choice and Termination of Pregnancy Amendment Bill as it addresses current shortcomings with regard to access to termination of pregnancy services for women. We have achieved much since the enactment of the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act in 1996. This act resulted in a major breakthrough for women's reproductive rights in keeping with the South African Constitution. There has been a dramatic decline in deaths associated with abortion since the Act's implementation in 1994. since the Act's implementation in 1997. In 1994, a study conducted by the Medical Research Council in South Africa reported 425 deaths due to unsafe abortion. In 2006, the Saving Mothers Confidential Inquiry into Maternal Death in South Africa reported that there were 34 maternal deaths related to abortion in 1 year. This translates into a 90% reduction in deaths due to unsafe abortion. There's also been a striking decrease in abortion-associated illnesses or morbidity. In a study of hospital admissions for incomplete abortions conducted in 1994, abortion-related morbidity was recorded at 15%. A similar study undertaken in 2000 showed that the abortion-related morbidity had decreased to 9%. However, barriers to accessing early legal termination of pregnancy services still exist, as evidenced by the fact that unsafe, illegal termination of pregnancies still occur. Furthermore, a quarter of legal terminations are performed after 12 weeks of pregnancy, and these second trimester procedures are medically more complicated and have greater risks. A shortage of resources, both personnel and facilities, are responsible for difficulties in accessing early, safe, legal abortion care services, particularly in rural areas. We believe that the amendment bill improves access to safe legal termination of pregnancy services by empowering the MSC of the province, who is responsible for health, to approve health facilities where termination of pregnancy may be performed. Previously, this function was exercised by the Minister of Health of the national government. This decentralization, we believe, would shorten the process of designation of services. The amendment bill also allows registered nurses who have undergone training to perform termination of pregnancies of up to 12 weeks to perform termination of pregnancies. Previously, this was limited to just registered midwives. This will increase the pool of termination of pregnancy service providers and improve women's access to safe early termination of pregnancy services. Furthermore, the amendment bill allows 24-hour maternity services which comply with certain requirements to perform abortions of up to 12 weeks without having to obtain approval of the MEC. Once again, this will increase the number of services available to women seeking termination of pregnancies. In our submission, we did not mention the risks associated with the risk of breast cancer and abortion, but since this has been brought up, I would like to address it. We did not address it because we believe that this amendment bill did not address the Primary Act. I want to mention recent research that has been conducted around the risk of breast cancer and abortion. Recently, we had a group from Harvard University, Harvard Medical School, who reported, who conducted a study looking at induced and spontaneous abortion and the incidence of breast cancer among young women. This study was reported earlier this year in the Archives of Internal Medicine. It was a huge study of 105,000 women. And I just want to read the conclusion from this. Among this predominantly premenopausal group of women, neither induced nor spontaneous abortion was associated with the incidence of breast cancer. Another recent study published in the International Journal of Cancer last year and conducted by a group of epidemiologists and specialists at Oxford University. This research was conducted on 267,000 women, and in it, their conclusion, overall, the findings provide further unbiased evidence of the lack of an adverse effect of induced abortion on cervical cancer risk. There are numerous other studies, and I can make these available. This issue has been addressed many times. We had also a publication in The Lancet, a very prestigious medical journal, which reviewed 53 studies that had looked at the issue of breast cancer and abortion and also concluded that there was no increased risk. In conclusion, we believe that it is vital that we maintain the positive results that have been achieved since the implementation of the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Act of 1996 by accepting the Choice of Termination of Pregnancy Amendment Bill. This will result in increased access through the devolution of power from the national to the provincial government, and an increase in the number of healthcare providers and services available. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Jennifer Motley, for your submission. We shall hand over to honorable members to ask questions. Thanks.
Thank you. As you've just spoken about, the result will be the increased number of facilities and therefore the increased number of abortions. And with this in mind, do you perhaps see the benefit of strengthening the clause around counselling, knowing that obviously the adequate counselling is not taking place and it is able to be bounced around because there's no specific onus? So would you have any specific objection to that clause being tightened in terms of placing the onus on someone in particular, and also just clearly stipulating, as is done in the regulations, that the risks need to be clearly put, and also the choices need to be clearly put? So if you could just explain, if you do have objections to that, what would your objections be and why? And in terms then of conscientious objection, because again, increased facilities, increased amount of abortions would obviously mean increased pressure on those who do have beliefs and other reasons for not wanting to participate in TOP. So do you have any specific objection to a clause being included which would actually protect health workers in this instance? If you do have an objection, what is it? And I'd just like to mention there that obviously in discussing this, which we have done in depth over the years with dealing with this bill with the department, they have clearly said to me that they do not see that anybody should be able to avoid doing this, and would like to actually have prescribed at the time that health workers have to do this. So keeping that in mind, there is that sense of pressure already from the employer on the health workers. So if you could comment on those things.
Thank you. With regards to the issue of counselling, As it currently stands, when providers are trained, the issue of counselling is covered. And so providers of termination of pregnancy are being trained in counselling. I don't have an objection to counselling being done clearly. I think it's part of good practice for clients to be counselled. But what I would object to is if counselling is used as a means to prevent people from accessing services or as a means for one particular point of view to be pushed. With regard to conscientious objection, I do believe that people have the right to conscientiously object to conducting a procedure, but that then they must refer the client so that she's able to access the service. I think as the Act stands, it does make provision through the Constitution for health workers to conscientiously object, but they must make provision for a woman to be able to access the service.
According to our constitution, there's freedom of religion, belief, and opinion. And there's also the right to access of information. Now, of the two, which one weighs heavier than the other? There is this woman who is religious, who is conscious, of not conducting or performing abortion. But there is this patient who has the right to access of information from this particular person who needs to refer to a facility where she can be able to be attended to. And this is not happening. What is your opinion? Secondly, on the misoprostol, which is readily available over the counter by even the private practitioners and pharmacies, the facilities that are providing for this service, it's not accountable to such practices because they don't know when this woman gets the misoprostol because she gets it over the counter. So whose fault is it? Because women who are attending the facility, they are being trained and educated how to take the misoprostol and when to come back for assistance at the particular facility. Can you clarify me on those two issues, please?
In response to the first scenario of a woman seeking a determination of pregnancy and a provider who feels strongly that she can't be involved in this, I believe that the provider does have the right not to be involved, but she also has taken an oath in her training, medical or nursing, to make sure that her client's health is upheld, and it's that she needs to honor and refer the client appropriately. With regard to misoprostol, I think the fact that this is happening bears witness to the fact that access to services is a problem. And I think we need to make services more available. That to me is the solution. The fact that these things are happening, that it could be an unsafe procedure, which then is the burden falls on the health services. But in the process, it could also harm the woman. We need to make sure that we increase access to services, and that's what I think the amendment bill is trying to address. Thank you.
If I could just follow up on what I was saying earlier, just in line with the testimony that we've had from doctors today, the fact that thousands of health workers find themselves under pressure to perform abortions contrary to their consciences and religious beliefs, and that our 10 years now has proved that the Constitution does not provide sufficient protection for those people. And just the court case that was cited, Charles and others versus Gauteng Health Department, where the three judges in the Labour Court handed down a judgment which stressed the need for ministers to provide certainty in this area of law. So with that in mind, you mentioned that the Constitution would be sufficient, but on the testimony of those who are working on the ground, would you not agree that perhaps it's not sufficient and that we do need to bring certainty and clarify this issue, and this would be an ideal opportunity to do so?
With regard to the whole conscientious objection, I think that we can cite, I mean, you have cited an example of where doctor felt coerced to do this. And I'm not saying that we're in agreement with doctors being coerced or medical practitioners being coerced, but to me the solution needs to be to uphold the Constitution. And I don't think that putting anything in the pathway which inhibits women from accessing services is going to help the situation. The doctors or any medical providers have the Constitution available to them. And I do think cases like this need to be heard. But it is, and the Constitution simply needs to be upheld. I think providing a clause that then can be used as an excuse for not giving access to services would be a problem for me.
So in your view, Dr. Moodley, the current provision as outlined in the Principal Act with regards to consent are sufficient?
In my view, it is sufficient.
Yes.
Where
the matter raised in terms of the conscientious objection, you feel that there's no need to put that as a specific clause, given that the other, you know, statutes may actually cover that particular point. In your own view?
In my view, the Constitution covers that.
The point that was raised by Doctors for Life around, I think it was misoprostol, that creates a peculiar dilemma in terms of conscientious objection, given already that produces induced abortion. What's your own comment on that one?
My own comment is that that just, to me, brings about, highlights the point that women need better access, and that this is precisely what the bill is trying to address. I think that what's happening is not correct, but it is an issue of access. Women resort to these things because they don't have access.
In terms of the amendment bill here, B21-207, that extends the persons designated, it says a medical practitioner, registered midwife, or a registered nurse. So you think that one, the registered nurse who has completed the prescribed training course, will now cover some of the shortages in terms of personnel, as outlined in the earlier presentation? What's your own view on that? In terms of the nurse now, earlier legislation said it's a midwife who has completed a specific training, not specific, a prescribed training, and the medical practitioner. So actually refer favorably to the question of the insertion around the role of the nurse, registered nurse who has undergone such a training. That's your bullet number 3 on page 3. Number 2 on page 3.
Yes, I think that allowing registered nurses to perform termination of pregnancies will greatly increase the pool. At the time that I know from training in this province that at the time training was conducted, there were registered nurses who indicated that they were willing to do these procedures, but by law were not allowed to. So I think by having registered nurses and obviously undergoing the appropriate training, we're going to increase that pool and then increase access to services.
Just on that point, there have been quite a few comments with regard to the increased risks with the sort of shorter course of nurses or midwives as opposed to doctors, and things like the manual vacuum aspiration, abortions, the damaged internal organs, severe bleeding, those kind of consequences, just that termination would be exposed to greater risk, and, you know, various health groupings that I see here. I have actually commented quite strongly on the fact that doing this would actually create added risk for the woman who's undergoing TOP. Could you comment on that?
You know, the person we're talking about adding to the pool is a registered nurse who is performing procedures. It's not a lay person that's going to perform these procedures. They're trained to perform many other procedures. They will now receive added training to perform specifically termination of pregnancies. With any procedure, there's a risk, but I think with appropriate training, we decrease that risk.
On a study that we did, which was published in the Lancet, which was an international study, but we did it here in South Africa as well, and we looked it was a reference to a specific thing, what you were saying. We looked at doctors and nurses and compared them. These are what the percentage of randomized controlled trial to see what the outcome was, and it was looking at complications from the nurses and from the doctors, and we found there was no increase complications amongst the nurses. This was done here, was done in Vietnam, and was done in a few areas of South Africa.
So we say that doctors and nurses can equally, at that time it was only midwives obviously who were doing it, but the midwives and the doctors, it was equally effective and the complication rate was very low amongst both.
Any other questions before formal? Thank you very much. I think the
submission has greatly assisted us very much. We want to suggest, honorable members, we go to lunch. It's in this building. Yes, just go out, then turn right straight. You see the dining hall. We're all invited to lunch there. And then we come back at 2, and then we proceed from there. Thanks.